open the Senate Revenue Committee. Good morning. We are going to have public hearings, and I think we're scheduled for possible work sessions. And the order that we're going to go in this morning is we're going to do Senate Bill 268 first, followed by Senate Bill 267, and then Senate Bill 29. And then we'll see in terms of whether we can move any of these right towards the end. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 268. Paul Warner.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 268 comes to you from the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary, pre-session filed bill. What it does is it eliminates the tax court small claims procedure by repealing House Bill 305.514. And I can see my first mistake of the session is I put 314 on your preliminary staff measure summary, but it's actually 305.514. And that statute, I went ahead and made a copy for you. It's a small claims procedure, and talks about how an appraisal of property in lieu of hearing is carried out. And we do have Judge Breithoff here from the tax court, and they are the ones who have brought this forward.
Judge Breithoff, and I hope I pronounced your name correctly. And Ms. Tanner, or, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You did pronounce my name either correctly or close enough that you will get a high grade in German.
I guess I'm safer if I just say Your Honor, and then...
you could, although I'm glad to go by the name, which is bright like a light and hop like a rabbit. That's as close as I think generally we get. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair Starr. My name is Henry Breithoff, and I am the judge of the Oregon Tax Court. With me today is the Honorable Jill Tanner, who is the presiding magistrate of the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court. And we are here to support the Senate Bill 268. As Mr. Warner mentioned, the purpose of this statute is to take away or eliminate the small claims division currently operates within the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court. And the reason for that is this. The Magistrate Division of the Court was created by this body effective for the September 1, 1997. Prior to that time, the initial hearings in tax disputes were carried on by the Department of Revenue. And if a taxpayer did not like what the department did, the taxpayer came over, I say over because we're east of the railroad track, came over to the Oregon Tax Court, which had one judge, and said, I don't like what the department did. And it was in that tax court proceeding that they, in effect, appealed what the department did to a judicial officer. The legislature recognized that in the court system, there might well be disputes about small amounts of income tax or small amounts of property value, and shouldn't there be a less formal procedure for this appeal than the full-blown tax court process? And so the legislature prior to 97 had put in place the Small Claims Division, a lower filing fee, a much less formal process, but no appeal. In other words, you do small claims, that's it. No appeal to the Supreme Court. Now, in 97, the process was, if the taxpayer has a dispute with the Department of Revenue, now instead of a hearing before the department, the legislature said, we're going to create the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court, staff it with what now is five magistrates, and instead of having your hearing inside the Department of Revenue, you're going to go immediately to the judicial branch and have a hearing at the Magistrate Division. If either party doesn't like what goes on there, they can come to the judge of the regular division. That's me. Now, the process that was set up by the legislature for 1997 was to have a magistrate division that was much more user-friendly. The rules of evidence applicable in court cases do not have to apply and do not apply. The rules of procedure are much less strict. There is a formal and informal practice of mediation or alternative dispute resolution that occurs. And the fee is $25 rather than the $50 fee to the regular division. However, for whatever for reasons that I'm not aware of, the legislature in 97 still retained the small claims practice. So that now when a citizen comes over to the court, their choice is pay $10 and have small claims, pay $25 and have the user-friendly magistrate process, and then, depending on the outcome, if you chose the magistrate process, you can appeal on to the judge. If you chose $10 in small claims, you can't appeal on to the judge. And I think it's safe to say Magistrate Tanner and I have meet regularly with respect to administration issues on the court. Our feeling is that we've got too much complexity here for a number of reasons. It's difficult for taxpayers who now, by the way, for the most part, when they come to the court for that first hearing in the magistrate division, do not have a lawyer. They can represent themselves. An accountant can represent them. A tax return preparer, a real estate agent. There's a broad, much broader sense of representation. They now are presented with, well, do I pay $10 and go to the small claims? Do I even qualify for small claims? And we have found, as we look at it, that the question of do you qualify for small claims is not a simple question.
That's what I was going to ask, is what is the, I guess there's no simple answer to that, what is the cap that gets me into small claims versus...
Sure.
I'll ask Magistrate Tanner to...
Sure, and there is a cap, by the way. There's one for property tax and there's one for income. For property tax, it's a value of $250,000. And then for income tax, it's $5,000 of amount at controversy. So the thresholds are there. The statute also has some particular issues with the type of controversy, the type of item that you're bringing. On the property tax side, in other words, you can't bring an exemption case under small claims, but you might not necessarily be able to understand that by a quick reading, especially if you're non-trained in the law when you read the statute. And you're looking for an avenue. If someone gives you a choice between $10 or $25, say, well, gee, I think I'll take the 10. And not understanding that, and then that's when the complications start occurring. When the choices are made that are not covered by the statute, then we have the administrative issues from our side. Plus, it also elongates the process for the taxpayer and additional sort of creates a little bit of a controversy with them immediately. You don't qualify, and then there's already a controversy about this whole matter, and it's just not the best way we'd like to start a proceeding in the court.
Mm-hmm. And, Judge, we need to get your name.
Tanner, T-A-N-N-E-R.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
And our experience over now approximately 7 years is twofold. One, the difference between the $10 and the $25 process can be confusing. Number two, there aren't that many people that use the small claims process. And frankly, number three, we're not sure that taxpayers that choose the $10 option understand that if they do so, that's it. Whatever decision they get, it's over. Mm-hmm. There's no appeal. And we also believe very strongly that the original reason behind small claims was, let's have an alternative to a full-blown, the citizens should have an alternative to a full-blown judicial proceeding. Well, that's the real function of the magistrate division, and I will tell you, because I think Magistrate Tanner may be reluctant to, I think the magistrate division is performing that function remarkably well. Citizens get user-friendly hearings, cases get resolved, a vast majority of them get resolved at the magistrate division. It is the user-friendly, less complex process. And so our thought is, let's simplify the process, two choices, instead of two choices, one choice. Come to the magistrate division, pay $25, have a user-friendly hearing, and if you don't like what happened, you can come up and talk to the regular division judge. That'll cost you $50.
One quick question. And I know this is a ballpark. What percentage of those who go through the $10 route, I think that would be human nature, probably if they're in the small claims, I'll take the $10. Do you know, just ballpark, what percentage actually then would hope to appeal but are denied that opportunity? And maybe the way to calculate that is just how many appeal on the $25 route
Let me speak to the how many appeal on the $25 route. Fewer than 10% of the cases that come to the magistrate division end up coming on to the regular division. Hmm. So the magistrate division, day in and day out, deals with tax disputes in Oregon. Finally, and when I say finally, either party, if they're dissatisfied, can appeal. So what the magistrate has come to as a result is a result that's acceptable to both parties, the government and the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. That 10% figure, I think, unfortunately, on the question of how many people that use small claims might have wanted to appeal the result, we don't know because there's not a way for them to indicate that. You see, once they're done, they're done. But I would ask Magistrate Tanner if, anecdotally, whether you've heard screams and yells, and gee, I wish I could appeal, and I can.
Mr. Chairman, I would have to say that we do a lot of upfront discussion about the fact you've elected a small claims and that there are no more appeals, that there's no opportunity to appeal. So it's probably not too often that someone is caught unaware of the fact that they can't appeal at the end of the proceeding.
Hmm. Questions?
Nope.
Very clear.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Thank Anything you. Further that we should know?
I think, frankly, the revenue impact of this, which is the, in a sense, the other side of the coin from the taxpayer impact, is very small. Mm-hmm. This is not designed to raise revenue through an increased filing fee. It's really designed to, if you will, rationalize a process and make it simpler and easier to use. Mm-hmm. We think it's a good idea, and we are conscious, especially the magistrate division, of the impact on taxpayers. We think it will have, notwithstanding the slightly greater fee, will have a positive impact there as well. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Appreciate it.
No, Mr. Chair.
Senator
Brzezinski. Yeah, I glanced at the written material you provided. And for me, looking at an estimate of an increase in revenue of less than $3,000, I mean, the reality is that's something that's definitely doable. And when you think about the cost of doing business, having people pay 25 versus 10 for this type of opportunity to have the claim being adjudicated, seems to be quite reasonable when you think about what the county cost is if they went into a court to do a filing fee. It's clearly over $25.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Would you like us to remain here for the next bill as well?
Yes, and let me see, Paul.
I just wanted to just follow up on the revenue and fiscal impact. We did get an official minimal fiscal impact from LFO, so fits within that category for them, where it's not quantified, not large enough to be quantified.
No. Good. We like. Hopefully, all the bills will fit into not large enough to be quantified.
Mm-hmm.
Let's remember that phrase. Department of Revenue, do y'all have thoughts or thumbs up? Two of them. Great. Well, we appreciate the work that you put into this, and I will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 268.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation discussion. Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Starr, would you be willing to carry that? Okay. Senate Bill, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 267. And Dr. Ayala, I think, is our staffer on this one. And, yes, Judge Breithaupt and Judge Tanner are also presenting this bill to us, and we'll allow staff to introduce it and then go to our panel.
Yes, Senate Bill 267 allows the Oregon Tax Court to determine real market value of specially assessed property based on evidence before the court without regard to the values of the pleaded parties. Allows the court to rule on appeals that are pending in tax court on the effective date of the bill. A little background on this. I will say that probably be explained better by our guest. But what I was told yesterday in speaking with you was that the Oregon Tax Court had this authority to determine real market values without regard to values pleaded by parties back in prior to 97. But in 97, there were some major changes undertaken in order to restructure the appeals process. A statute was repealed in order to create the magistrate division. And in so doing, one section of the statute was inadvertently repealed. And this is the section that dealt with the court's ability to determine real market values of property without regard to the values pleaded by parties. This particular bill reinstates the authority, but only for the valuation on specially assessed properties. That's what I had read. At that time, there were no cases pending appeal in the tax court that pertained to the valuation of specially assessed properties.
So what are specially assessed properties?
Properties that, I'm trying to think of examples. They have, not. It's not properties that have partial exemption. They have, Paul? I'm not sure, specially assessed. Given clarification on that.
Well, I think the panel will, our judges are probably well aware of and deal with this on a weekly basis. Thank you, Judge Tanner and Judge Breithaupt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, I am Henry Breithaupt, the judge of the Oregon Tax Court, appearing in support of Senate Bill 267, which was introduced at the request of OJD and ourselves. Let me say right at the very beginning one thing that may be helpful. The bill does not just deal with specially assessed values, but the determination of real market value or the determination of specially assessed value. In either case, this bill has effect. And if I may, it would be a good way to address this. The typical residential house, there's no special assessment involved. The question is, or can be, what is the real market value of this house? And that determination will lead to a series of consequences in the property tax system. Alternatively, perhaps the best example of special assessment is farm use assessment, where the legislature for years has made the policy choice that farmland on the outskirts of urban areas will not be valued according to its real market value, or not be taxed according to its real market value. But instead, we will look at a special assessment scheme, namely, how much money does the land make as a farm? That's a special assessment example. Now, in either case, the question of valuation can come and does regularly come to the court. And just for as an example, typically the Department of Revenue or the county believes that the value is higher than what the taxpayer believes. So for an example that I'll continue to use, let's assume that the county or department says the land is worth, or the property is worth $400,000. And the taxpayer says, and this says this in pleadings, No, my property is only worth $200,000. So now there's a bracket that has been established by the pleadings. Prior to 1997, the Oregon statutes provided that the tax court was not limited by that range of $200 to $400. If the actual evidence in the case, not what the judge just thought, but rather the actual evidence in the case showed to the judge's view that the value was either above 400 or below 200, the judge could issue a judgment saying that's the value of the property. The legislation which created the magistrate division, in addition to a number of very specific statutes, had one section which took about 15 different statutory provisions and simply said, these are hereby repealed, gone. One of those, and I believe it was inadvertent, but I must tell you that is an educated guess, and I don't know the exact reason, but it was repealed in a, like I say, a 15 statute chunk of these are repealed. One of the statutes that was repealed was the statute which said that the court had the authority in either real market or special valuation cases to go beyond the bracket established by the pleadings. When that came to light, it came to light in a case that I decided called chart development. I looked at what the law was, and statute had been repealed. I then looked at prior case law, and one of my somewhat distant predecessors, Carlisle Roberts, who was an advisor to the legislature during much of his career, he had held at an old time before that statute ever existed. He said, "Well, if the court shouldn't go beyond the pleadings." So initially it was the court shouldn't go beyond the pleadings. Then the legislature said the court may go beyond the pleadings. Then in 97, I believe inadvertently, that authority was canceled. And what this bill brings to you is the reestablishment of that authority for either the magistrates of the court or the judge of the court on the basis of the evidence to find, in my example, for the taxpayers at 200, departments at 400, if the proof shows 450, the court can find 450. Alternatively, if the proof shows 150, the court can find 150. And we believe that's just a good administration rule. Currently, the way we deal with the fact that the statute has been repealed is that the decision in the chart case has told the lawyers, at least in the community, if you believe your proof is going to show a value beyond where your pleadings are, please file a motion to amend your pleadings. And good lawyers will do that. Mm-hmm. And we will have another motion, and that will solve the problem. I think we've already described to you that the bulk of the work of the tax court occurs in terms of numbers of cases at the magistrate division. And again, we've also described to you at that division, typically lawyers aren't present. And so citizens are caught with this problem of, well, what's a pleading and what's a motion and mm-hmm. how do I amend my motion to conform to the proof and what does that mean? Gee whiz, I thought it was 200, but now I realize my witness, the appraiser, has actually shown that it's only worth 150. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'd like, is the 150. And so this really says, let's put back authority that existed for 20 years, make everyone's life a little easier. And I stress, this does not just unleash the magistrate or the judge to come up with any old value. What it says is, if the evidence supports a value outside the pleadings, you're free to find that without having to amend the pleadings. I would describe it as a good housekeeping provision in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to determine, I guess the two questions that come to mind are, one is what would constitute evidence? An assessor's, how would you go about in adjudicating a case, look at what is the evidence that this is a 150, this is valued at 150 in the example, or 450?
Okay. And if I may, just for ease, stay with the example of a private residence house, in which those kinds of values would be relevant. The typical case prepared, even modestly well prepared, the evidence before either the magistrate or the judge would typically be testimony or documentary evidence brought by an appraiser of some form who would say, I looked at the residence house, I looked at the community around it, I looked at recent sales of similar properties, and in my opinion, this house is worth whatever. And the other side would say, well, we did the same thing, but you know, We have a different set of what are called comparables. We believe that the house in question looks more like these houses up on the hill mm-hmm. and much less like the houses down in the floodland. Mm-hmm. And we therefore dispute. And the judge or magistrate's job is to look at the law, look at the prior case law, use good sense, and decide which is the more comparable set of evidence. Mm-hmm. And that will support the finding of value. That would be the typical residential property. Once you get beyond a typical residential property into any kind of an industrial or commercial property, you're typically going to see a more sophisticated case presented by professional appraisers who look at a number of different indicators of value. It will become more complex, but the basic problem is the same. What would the property sell for in an open market?
Senator Starr.
Based on your testimony, it would seem that the most likely solution is going to fall between the two, that each will try to substantiate their case, but you're going to have to end up probably solving that somewhere in between.
I believe that even on the original pleadings, if we just take the situation that exists now, which is that the original pleadings unamended set the goal, the sidelines of the field, the vast majority of the cases will be decided somewhere in between. But especially in more complex cases, for example, evaluation of an operating plant, an industrial plant, frankly, until the appraisers actually go out and start doing their appraisal, they sometimes don't understand all of the complexity. And once they've done that appraisal, they come into the court and they say, well, you know something. Our initial thought was 400. But now that we've looked at it, it's actually 450. Or conversely, we thought it was 200, it's 250. I think as a practical matter, the example of the residential house is unlikely to statistically be very present. But the more complex the property, the more likely the parties will have an initial idea about value, but as they actually work on their case, that idea will get sharpened, and it could move beyond their initial pleadings. It will happen in a limited number of cases, but when it does, this bill says, okay, no need to file additional motions. Let's just go ahead to a decision on the record.
So, Judge, and what was the rationale behind, and I guess it was a 97 decision, of getting those brackets in place? I mean, your intuition is that, well, once you get the kind of the parameter set, you can expedite those negotiations. If it's 200 and 400, that gives you a field of play to just move forward. And the only hesitation, and I don't know, I'm interested to hear the 97 rationale if there was one, is that this would maybe lengthen the process, because once you've unset those 200 and 400, then you could have more pleadings and more amended motions. And
yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Actually, the situation in 97 was that the expansive authority, the more expansive authority which we're talking about, was the rule. Mm-hmm. There was no limit by the pleadings. Mm-hmm. All that 97 did was to take an eraser and erase that provision.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, as far as I can tell from looking at it, there was no legislative history as to why that was done. In other words, I understand your question to be, did the legislature put into place that bracketed system in 97? And the answer is, no, they didn't. What they did was to take away the unbracketed system. And what I concluded in the Chart case, which was decided, was, well, if the legislature took away the statutory authority for an unbracketed system, where are we? And I found a 1977 case decided by the tax court which said in those instances, that is, at that time, there was no authority to go where the evidence led. And the judge, my predecessor, had said, in that case, I'm going to stay within the pleadings. I think that's the way to go. And I said, well, he was a wise man. I'm going to follow his lead. I will tell you personally that I believe that he was happy because he served then into the system where there was an ability to go beyond the pleadings. I believe he felt that was a good system. And it was, frankly, in my view, in 1997, it was just inadvertently executed. And we're saying, please resurrect it.
And you don't find it that it would be more acrimonious or lead to greater length in terms of the cases that you're working on to have?
I would like to ask the presiding magistrate Tanner to comment on that with respect to the magistrate division, and then I'll comment on it with respect to the regular division.
Thank you, Judge. And I am Jill Tanner, presiding magistrate of the Oregon Tax Court. One of the things that I, before responding directly to the question, is that we put it, by putting great importance on these pleadings, remember from a pro se standpoint, they're very concerned about getting in the door. They don't want the time to run. So when you're locked into a value put on a pleading, a lot of times it is nothing more than a place saver. I need to put a value in there. I need to get my pleading into the court. With respect to settlement of an issue, no matter what value is put there, we really encourage settlement, a mediation program in the court. And we don't find that anybody's constrained, particularly by what has been pled or not been pled. Everybody's working to try to resolve and get a reasonable fair market value and sort of resolve the appeal. So I personally don't feel, based on what I've seen in the last 7 years, that this would have an impact or does have an impact. I think it just protects the pro se's from finding themselves in a situation where they don't understand the complexities of what pleadings are and how they can be locked into something that they were just trying to get their foot in the door, and now they're sort of, like I say, locked in to a particular position. Mm-hmm. So I just think it offers that.
At the regular, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, at the regular division, first of all, Magistrate Tanner's reference to pro se's, that's a reference to a taxpayer who does not have a lawyer, who is representing themselves. That is much less the case at the regular division. By the time the case works its way to the regular division, typically lawyers have shown up. And I will say that in my experience, I would expect there to be no effect by this legislation other than we would do away with one round of motions to motions which I will say, and I said in the chart opinion, I would be inclined to grant. If a lawyer has pled a value of $1 million at the beginning, and they're witnessed, let's say they're the taxpayer, so they want the lowest value, they pled $1 million, they worked on the case for 3 months with their expert witness, and they concluded that it was actually $750,000. If they raise their hand and say, Your Honor, we exchanged these exhibits. There's no surprise. We'd like to amend our pleadings. May we do so? I have said in the opinion, and I've said publicly, I will be inclined to grant that motion. It's only the fair thing to do. So I think the effect of this day-to-day will be minimal. In fact, really use the term non-quantifiable.
I like that. We don't like sending our bills down to Ways and Means that are non-quantifiable. Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Chair. I think the only question I have, and it may be more for staff, understand what happened. If there had to be a bill that this got erased from, maybe if we just had the bill itself so we could put it in context as to whatever other work was being done, I clearly understand how this could and probably did just occur. Through the drafting with LC and something got dropped or with revenue, whatever. And I've pretty well tracked everything, but it seems like for clarity, if we move this bill forward, it would be nice to have that information so if there's a question that comes from the floor, we'll be able to give it in a context of how this played out and why to some level.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Senator Przanski, we would be glad to provide a copy of the bill that led to the creation of the Magistrate Division and within which this erasing occurred. And we will submit that in response to this request to the committee staff.
Other questions for our judges? So we'll thank you very much. So we'll hold on to this bill. I think we're going to have the tax court. We have a couple other bills dealing with the tax court that we'll have. So we'll probably put this back on our agenda for when we deal with other tax court bills.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else on Senate Bill 268, Department, do you need to say anything on this
267.
One?
267. We've done.
Good attention to detail, Senator Przanski.
Sorry.
Oh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I did not sign up, but the department believes that a correct value on property fairly distributes the burden of the property tax. That's fundamental. And so our effort is always to seek the correct real market value. And if that allows in the case of chart development that the judge mentioned, I think the judge was inclined to rule higher on the value and more a higher value than what we even asked for. So in that case, it would have benefited our case. The bill cuts both ways. It would allow the judge either direction. And it is also discretionary. It doesn't require the judge to do anything in that regard. So we're fine with the bill.
Great. Appreciate it. Questions? Thank you. close the public hearing on Senate Bill 267 and move on to the final bill we have up this morning, which is Senate Bill 29. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 29. Dr. Ayala.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The bill actually clarifies that a property's real market value, not assessed value or some other value, will be multiplied by the percent change ratio in order to determine that property's maximum assessed value. We've recently discussed the issue of how new properties or additions to new properties have been put on the roll during orientation. And basically, it's very intuitive that you would use real market value and multiply it times some factor in order to get down to the maximum assessed value. Unfortunately, the actual language in the statute does not have the word real before the formula that's used to get to maximum assessed value. So this is really a clarification. And we have attached a letter that was sent to Dr. Warner in September that reiterates what I've just said, basically, that it's very intuitive that you would imply the percent change ratio to a real market value in order to come up with your maximum assessed value. And so this is really a clarification of what's being already applied by assessors.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I guess the real question, at least the first one is do we need this law? If that's the current practice, do we need a law to basically codify what's currently occurring? And Mr. Bryant is floating around, but he's not here, and I guess he's the best one to answer that. But Department, I don't know if y'all would like to take a swing at that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips again with the Department of Revenue. The department's interpretation of this statute from day one has been that it is real market value. It's consistent with the proposed change in the bill. We've instructed the counties agree with us, and that's how it's being implemented throughout the state. I understand there was a situation of a case in Deschutes County where a colleague of ex-Senator Bryant may have interpreted otherwise or was unclear to him, and that generated the bill. But whether it's required or not, it may provide some clarification for someone that's unfamiliar with the property tax statutes. But they are somewhat complex, and so I can see where someone might have a problem with it in the future.
There's the heavy hitters.
Yeah.
Well, here comes the... So
the A team has arrived.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate trashing of this bill and your violent opposition to its passage, but let's at least hear from the proponents before we... Senator Westland, Senator Bryant. We normally have the one with the jacket go first, but I guess protocol dictates that we'll let the senator from Tumalo speak first.
Senator Ben Westland, senator from Central Oregon, good bill, should pass. I will allow my colleague that is properly attired to address any of your concerns.
Well, we're just struggling, Senator, with the whole real market versus assessed market. And if you could help us understand, especially the case law, that Mr. Bryant's colleague had, where he had at least some level of confusion in terms of how these assess. So before we hand it over, I'd be really interested to hear Senator Westland address this and help us and the department in terms of determining real versus assessed property value in cases that are adjudicated.
Well, real value has to do with what money changes hands when a willing buyer approaches a willing seller, and they actually do come to an agreement, as opposed to the governmental process of assessing a property that is a very vague and murky computation. That's what we're trying to establish here. Now, if you'd like any more clarity, and for the purpose of not confusing the committee, I really do think it's appropriate that the individually, sartorially attired in the jacket address any of your big concerns.
Senator Bryant.
Thank you. My name is Neil Bryant, and I'm honored to be referred to as a senator. I'm an attorney from Central Oregon, and I learned after my second term ended that you retain the title forever. And I further learned that if you're subsequently elected to another position, then you retain that title and you lose your old one. So the future protocol for you who have higher political ambitions, that's the way it works. I want to compliment the committee on Senate Bill 29 on how quickly you scheduled the hearing. I got the call from Senator Westland, I think, on Monday, and I hadn't even seen a printed copy of the bill until today. It's my understanding you have a letter that I forwarded to Senator Westland when I asked him to introduce the bill, and the purpose is to try to eliminate some confusion on things when they lose their special assessment, and for people who read the statute, including attorneys and assessors. This came out of an incident in Deschutes County, and they came to the right conclusion, but it took a lot of time and effort because just the verbiage and the wording seemed inconsistent. So I guess if I could summarize what this change does, it won't change the law, but by making this correction, the thought would be it'd be clear, and then the ambiguity would be in favor of the taxpayer as they read the statute. So that's the purpose for why it was introduced. And being in this room and having served on the Senate Revenue Committee when we tried to implement Measure 46, realized we couldn't, and then had to go back out with Measure 50 and implement that. Coming here every day was called Groundhog's Day because it seemed like that movie where every day you wake up and you just start all over again with the same issues. That's what we experienced. So I want to compliment the 97 legislature for what they did. And the implementation bill was 200 to 300 pages, and these definitions of real market value and assessed value and all the other things. The legislature and the committee and the staff did a wonderful job, that there haven't been more issues and more corrections.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chair, not to correct the far more informed individual to my left, but it was not ballot measure 46.
What was it?
Ballot measure 47.
Oh, I'm sorry. 47.
Should be consideration for a no vote.
we were confused and disoriented for a few moments there, and I'm glad we're back. Sure. We're back. We're on track. Any questions? Yeah, Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I was just so pleased with the former senator making that statement that this we were going to actually do something in this committee that would might be beneficial to taxpayers, and that I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. This is day, you know, this is the first day we've had bills up, and we're...
What a good start.
Exactly. Other questions or comments for the panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close public hearing, open a work session. Committee, you've heard the rationale for it is that this is being practiced, but it might clarify the practice that the Department of Revenue and county assessors are having.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 29 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 29 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection? So ordered, and Senator Westland will be our carrier. We are concluded for today. Thank you to our judges for the two prior bills, and we are almost done with the week. We have corporate tax tomorrow and a couple of bills, and Senator Nielsen has a bill up. And Senator Nielsen has some folks coming in from Eastern Oregon on that one.
Okay.
We are adjourned.